You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We're delighted to welcome Dr. Jenny Goodman, author of Staying Alive in Toxic Times, and this one, Getting Healthy in Toxic Times. And she's here at the Pagoda, her first time at Greenbelt, to help us explore from her position as an ecological doctor what we can do to protect ourselves from pollution, chemicals and toxins that pervade our environment, be that the food we eat, the water we drink, or the air that we breathe. A specialist in nutritional and environmental medicine for over 20 years, we're delighted to welcome Jenny to the Pagoda and to learn more from her. She's going to be following this talk with a book signing at 5 p.m. over in G Books across the way, and she'd be delighted to meet you there. And she informs me that she's also around for some of the rest of the weekend, so if you don't get a chance to do that. But Pagoda, please give a very warm welcome to Dr. Jenny Goodman.
Thank you, Christine, and thank you, everybody, for coming. How are you? Are you well? Good. Is everybody you know well as well? No, that's why we're here. Okay. So, can you hear me all right? Okay. I think we're all aware that the environment is in crisis. But the bit of that we're mostly aware of is the climate change bit. I'm not going to talk about that much because everybody's talking about it. I'm going to be talking about all the other kinds of harm that the petrochemical industry has done to our earth and our water and our air and to our bodies, and what we can do about it, both on the individual level to protect ourselves and our health and the health of those we love, but also on the political, collective level of campaigning, fighting for change. Because my basic credo here is you can't poison the planet without poisoning the people, and we have been doing both. And there's a kind of health world and an environmental activism world, and they're not talking to each other, and we need to join the dots, right? So there's a campaign to save the birds, save the badgers, save the beavers, save the bees. There isn't a campaign to save the humans, but just like the wildlife, the trees, the plants, all the other animals, we are profoundly affected by the toxins that we've been putting into our environment and therefore into ourselves, because we're not separate from our mother, the earth, and what goes around comes around, since the Industrial Revolution, so for about 200 years. And there are ways to reverse this. But first of all, before I link the environmental crisis that we all know about with the health crisis that we don't all know about, I want to explain what I mean by health crisis. And may I start by asking you a favour? Would you be kind enough to put up your hands if you know or have ever known a person with cancer? Please keep your hands up and look around the tent. It seems to me, thank you people, it seems to me that virtually every hand in the tent went up. Now, this is not normal, this is not natural, and this is not right, but this is the situation we have. If I had asked the same question of a comparable, you know, sociologically comparable audience, maybe 50 years ago, I think maybe 10 or 20 hands would have gone up. 100 years ago, maybe 4 or 5. 200 years ago, one or none. But it's very hard for us to see this. And of course, it's not just cancer I'm talking about. It's dementia, diabetes, heart disease, autoimmunity, neurodegenerative conditions, problems like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, motor neuron, and autism. All of these are epidemics which were known but vanishingly rare before the Industrial Revolution. But we can't see it because it's become so familiar, so normal. And what you do if your loved one gets cancer, God forbid, is you run a marathon and you do sponsored this and sponsor that, and you raise lots of money for research. Maybe we can talk later about what that research actually is, what it's doing and what it isn't doing. But my concern here is causes and prevention. Okay, and what we now know is that we are eating the causes of these epidemics. We are drinking the causes. We are inhaling the causes. And quite a lot of us, especially women, are rubbing the causes into our skin. So there's a concept in ecology, which I learned from Isabella Tree's book, Wilding, called shifting baseline syndrome. And it means that what you're used to is what's normal. So if an ecologist is, let's say, surveying a 1 mile square area of land to see how many bird species there are, and they do it today and they find there are 6 species of birds, but they know that 40 years ago there were 12 species of birds. So their restoration efforts are guided towards restoring it to another 12 species of birds. What they don't know is that 200 years ago there were 100 species of birds. We cannot know those things that were before our lifetime. So we cannot remember a time, any of us, when cancer and dementia were very, very rare. Let me first tell you what we're normally told about the causes for this, because epidemiologists who study these trends are quite openly admitting that these trends are there and that these things are getting terrifyingly common. But they will say, well, firstly, some of them will say it's genetics. Now, that's profoundly illogical because your genes don't change over 2 or 3 generations, virtually not at all. And, you know, the vast majority of people with these kinds of diseases did not have an ancestor with those diseases. So if it's genetic, you find it in your family. And mostly we don't. So anything that changes that fast in a matter of 2 or 3 generations, we are looking for environmental factors. Then we're told it's because we have an aging population. And I want to scotch that myth right at the beginning. Firstly, think about the logic that says, well, thanks to the wonders of modern medicine, we're all now living long enough to get all these hideous diseases. It doesn't compute in my brain. But there are 2 reasons why it's not true. One is, I'm really sorry to tell you such a downer at the beginning, but I promise you it will get more positive. Some of this stuff is very scary to know, but in my view, it's much scarier not to know it, because then we can't do anything about it. Once we know a problem exists, we can find the solutions, of which there are many. So the downer that I have to tell you is, when we're told, oh, cancer's going up because we've got an aging population, Alzheimer's is going up because we've got an aging population, the reason it's not true is actually cancer is going up much fastest among children, and also pretty fast among adolescents and people in their 20s and 30s. 50 years ago, this wasn't the case. When I left medical school, when I graduated in 1982, the very first children's hospice in the world came into existence. 50 years before that, it would have been unthinkable. So if cancer is going up faster among children and younger people, then it's not down to aging. The other reason that the aging story is a myth is as follows. We're always told our average age of death now is about, you know, 82, 83. Whereas if you go back to, say, the mid-19th century, the average age of death was 45. Right, that's true. But that 45 takes into account the fact that a quarter of the whole population died before the age of 5. Right, so all these kids were dying of infectious diseases, scarlet fever, TB, due to appalling living conditions, overcrowding, lack of hygiene, malnutrition. And they brought the average age of death down to 45. If you take those kids out of the equation, guess what their average age of death was? About the same as ours, the early 80s. The difference being, they did not live their last 10 years in a ghastly twilight of struggle and pain and suffering and needing loads and loads and loads of extra care. They lived fully, physically and mentally fit until they died. So we've done something wrong. And I've been busy finding out what it is so we can change it. Nothing I'm telling you was taught to me at medical school. I went to medical school hoping to learn not only how to heal the sick, although I was told not to say that at the interview because it was considered very uncool and too soft. But I also wanted to learn what caused illness and therefore how we could educate ourselves to stay healthy and learn prevention. Fast forward many years, they hadn't taught me any of that, but I've learnt it since through the British Society for Ecological Medicine, which is all about causes and prevention and making people better without making them worse. So more or less drug-free medicine. Let me tell you why it's called ecological medicine. That's what I've been practicing since about the year 1999. It's ecological in two senses. The first sense is that it sees the whole body as one joined up ecosystem. So, you know, if you go to your GP with, let us say, three problems, let's say you've got a rash all over your skin and you've got painful aching joints and you're wheezy, you can't breathe properly. Your GP will refer you, respectively, to the dermatologist, the rheumatologist, and the respiratory physician, the chest doctor. None of those three people will ever get in a room together and speak to each other. Not lack of time. If you put them in a room together, they wouldn't know what to say, because modern medicine studies and thinks in silos, in compartments. You've got your joints, you've got your lungs, you've got your skin, you've got your gut. But they don't see that it's all part of one body. So an ecological physician would say, what is at the root of this almost certainly inflammatory problem? What nutrients are missing? What toxins are in the system that are causing these inflammatory reactions in your skin and your lungs and your joints? So it's joined up in that sense. It's seeing the body as one ecosystem. But the kind of medicine I'm talking about is also ecological in an even more profound sense, which is it sees the human body as an inextricable part of planet Earth, which is our home. Just like our body is our home, our mother's body was our home, planet Earth is our home. What we put in the water and the air and the soil gets back into us. So that's where we need to start. So half of it is nutritional medicine, which is putting the good stuff back in. And the good stuff is missing, not only because of the junk food industry, which is vastly profitable and its products are highly addictive, but also because of many decades of intensive farming, especially the past 80 years, using synthetic fertilizers, getting more crops per year out of the ground than the ground is willing to give, and depleting all the nutrients in the soil. So when I would blood test people for mineral deficiencies, everything that was deficient, the magnesium, the zinc, the iodine, manganese, chromium, selenium, precisely what the organic farmers are finding when they test new soil before it's become organic, it's deficient in those minerals because of the preceding intensive farming. So it's quite hard to get all the good stuff in, even if you are eating a healthy diet. So putting the good stuff back in is half of how ecological medicine works. But that will be fairly familiar to you. There's thousands of books out there about nutrition. What may be less familiar is the other half of ecological medicine, which we call environmental medicine, and it's taking the bad stuff out. So the bad stuff is what's got into us, largely from the petrochemical industry. And let's start with the earth. Okay, for about 10,000 years, we were farming, intermittently hunter-gathering and increasingly farming, with just the earth and the animals pooing on the earth to fertilize the earth, just growing what we needed. And just using that totally organic approach, the population of the earth went up from something like a few hundred thousand to 2 million to 2 billion by the 1920s. Now, I'm saying that because the manufacturers of synthetic fertilizers and toxic pesticides and genetically modified seeds would have us believe that we need all those dangerous technologies in order to feed the burgeoning population of the earth, because there are going to be 10 billion of us and your organic farming is all very nice for you bunch of hippies, but it's never going to feed the world. Actually, it can. It has done and it can. So organic farmers don't use pesticides at all. And there are loads of other ways they stop pests from getting their crops. First of all, they don't do monocrop farming. Monocrop is one massive field covered with only wheat or only whatever it is. Now, if you're a pest that eats wheat and there's a big field of nothing else, you're going to call all your friends and relations in and say, hey, it's Christmas, let's eat this crop. So, of course, the farmer has to use heavy pesticides. Then the pest gets resistant, just like bacteria do to antibiotics. So you use more and more stronger and stronger things. This is the intervention cascade, which happens in agriculture as it does in medicine, using the chemical approach. And what organic farmers do is they don't do monocrops. They do what nature does, which is huge variety, biodiversity. abundance and many, many types of plants growing all together. You can harvest three crops together and then separate them. You can tolerate a few weeds that are good for the soil. And you can have animals fertilizing the earth naturally. You can do silvopasture, which is trees mixed in with the vegetables, the crops, whatever you're growing. Why is it important to do this? Why is it important for you to patronize your local organic farmer? Because here's what pesticides are. Pesticides and insecticides, herbicides, fungicides are a particular kind of petrochemical derived from nerve gases. They are made from nerve gases that were manufactured and used in both world wars. And when the Second World War ended in 1945, the manufacturers of those nerve gases could have said, thank goodness our product isn't needed anymore, we'll go and learn to play tennis or do ballet or something. They didn't do that. They wanted their profits to continue. So they repurposed the nerve gases and said to farmers, hey, these are pesticides, they'll kill the pests. And at that time, the government was wanting more and more intensive farming. They were still rationing. They were frightened that we might be cut off from our food supplies again. And the way they wanted everyone to produce more was by using the pesticides and the synthetic fertilizers, which are also derived from products of war, weapons of war. They are explosives. Don't know if anybody remembers, but in August 2020, there was a tremendous explosion in Beirut, and that was of a warehouse storing synthetic fertilizers. So they're still explosive. They're still used. They wash down off the soil into the rivers. They cause dead zones, algal bloom in lakes and rivers and huge areas of sea, which ironically are now dead and sterile as a result of excess fertilizers. So the simple way to avoid these being used on our planet and avoid them getting into your body is to buy organic. And to me, this is absolutely imperative. It's a form of health insurance. People have said to me, yeah, it's expensive. Well, it is a bit, but it depends how much you're eating. And if you're eating three chickens a week and they're battery farmed and produced with immense cruelty and the chickens can't live their natural lives, they can't range freely, therefore they're stressed, therefore their immune system goes to pieces, therefore they would go down with infections if the farmer didn't give them routine antibiotics every single day, which you're eating if you eat those chickens. Instead of having that kind of chicken three times a week, have an organic free-range chicken once a week. Less money, better for your health, better for the planet. Okay. So it is perfectly possible. And it's also a campaigning issue. We need to write to our MPs and say, hey, can you stop subsidising the big agri-chemical monocrop farms that are wrecking the green and pleasant land of England and wrecking everyone's health, and start subsidising the small human scale family farms which are doing it organically. I've spoken at lots of farmers' conferences, and all the farmers are desperate to go organic. They want to do it. The only obstacle is economic, and we can help as consumers by buying organic. Okay, what's in the water? I will cheer you up at the end, I promise. Okay, so eat organic is one crucial tip. The other crucial tip is, unless you live at the top of a mountain and get your water from a mountain spring or have a well in your garden, you need to get a water filter fitted, because what's coming out of the water is chlorine, increasingly in many parts of the UK, fluoride, plastics, microplastics, tiny particles of plastic. I'm delighted to see there's no plastic here. They've kindly given me a tin of water. This is a padded glass container for water. They won't let the kids take glass bottles into school. It's absolutely crazy. You can get them ready padded, or you can buy a little padded container from a camping shop. Plastic is a petrochemical as well. So everything that's coming out of the exhaust pipe and coal burning, oil burning, energy generation stations, that's all petrochemicals. So is plastic, so are pesticides, so are synthetic fertilizers, so are all the synthetic cosmetics you might put on your skin, so are all the synthetic fabrics you might be wearing that do not break down. All of that is petrochemical, and there are safe, natural alternatives, affordable, safe, natural alternatives to all of them. So the microplastics are coming out of your tap. They're also in the soil, particularly if it's not from an organic farm, and they're also in the air. And they're just about the only thing that we don't know how to detox, right? In my kind of medicine, we can detoxify the pesticides. We can detoxify the heavy metals that are there because we've been mining for almost as long as we've been farming. We've been mining up, digging up metals from the earth for about 5,000 years. And many of these metals are harmless if we leave them there in the crust of the earth. But they're not harmless when they're dug up. And of course, fossil fuels are contaminated with them as well. So we're inhaling, you know, the mercury, the cadmium, the nickel, the lead, the aluminium, and all of these toxic heavy metals. There are plenty of ways to detoxify them. I expect you're going to ask me about that in the question, so I won't go over it now. But there are plenty of simple ways to use nutrition to get the heavy metals out of your system. We can get the chlorine out. We can get the fluoride out. Plastics are much harder. You can get them out by using saunas in a very particular way. You sweat and you keep toweling off the sweat. Otherwise, the body will just reabsorb it because the body thinks you're sweating to cool down, doesn't know you need to detox. So there's plastic coming out of your tap. There's also what they call forever chemicals, PFAS, which is perfluoroalkyl substances or polyfluoroalkyl substances. They contain fluoride as well. And the synthetic bond between fluoride and carbon doesn't occur in nature. It's almost unbreakable. That's why these substances don't break down. But the good news is manufacturers are getting rid of them now because they used to be in waterproof clothing, in anything that was stain resistant, crinkle resistant, non-stick frying pans. It's increasingly easy to get cookware and rainwear and clothing that doesn't have the PFAS in. One final thing that may be in your tap water that probably hasn't occurred to you because it's not being put in there deliberately, which is your next door neighbour's drugs. Now, you may think you're very health aware and you don't take antibiotics, antidepressants, antihypertensives, anti-inflammatories. Notice, like, by the way, they all begin with anti. It's like what medicine is doing is fighting the body's processes instead of getting alongside it and figuring out what support the body needs. So all these anti-drugs, you may not be taking any of them, but your next door neighbour may be, and so may be your next door neighbour's pet, and so may be the farm animals on the non-organic farm down the road for reasons I explained with the chickens, right? The animals are stressed and so they get infections, so they need antibiotics. We all pee. The humans, the animals, the pets, the farm, we all pee, and any residue of any drug we've been taking goes into the water table. The water companies don't filter it out. All they're doing is getting rid of really scary bacteria like cholera, and they exist to make profit for their shareholders, not to give you nice, clean drinking water. So even though it sticks in the craw and goes against the grain, we need to buy a water filter. Now, the outdoor air is a bit harder to deal with, but that is a campaigning issue. The exhaust pipe is at the height of a toddler's nose. And on page 101 of my book, I've got a long list of all the toxic chemicals that are coming out of the exhaust pipe. There's about 15 of them. And somebody recently read that list and said to me, well, haven't you got carbon dioxide on the list? It is coming out of the exhaust pipe, but actually it's not toxic. So it's not on the list. So we have to think about how we're poisoning the planet, not just how we're warming it up, because the petrochemical industry is doing both these things. However, the air inside your house, you have far more control over than the air outside. So yes, we need brilliant public transport. We need not to use our cars so much. I'm not going to get into the debate about electric cars because yes, they're less polluting on site in the locale where they're used, but the batteries require rare earth minerals like lithium and nickel are being mined in places like the Congo by child slave labour. And there are islands in Indonesia, remote jungle islands, where people have lived in harmony with nature for thousands and thousands of years, naturally conserving the forest. There's nickel there. And these people are being thrown off their land to get the nickel for our batteries so we can drive electric vehicles and feel environmentally righteous. If you want to find out more about that, Survival International is the charity to find out from. Having said that, what you can do in your own home is go through each room in your house with a fine tooth comb. And if you're interested, chapter 7 of my book which is called The Surprising, subtitled The Surprising Poisonings of Everyday Life. Let's start in the kitchen. If you open the cupboard under the kitchen sink, what's there? Lots and lots of cleaning chemicals. Look closely. The skull and crossbones is on all of them. And the skull and crossbones means what it has always meant, which is this stuff is poison. Now, if you look up those chemicals, long list of chemical ingredients on the internet, you'll get what's called a data sheet. But that's telling you what happens if, God forbid, a child swallows some of it. That's acute poisoning. It's extremely rare. My concern is the chronic drip, drip, drip of very low level but regular poisoning every single day. So every time you take one of those toxic cleaners out and clean your work surface or clean your oven with it, you're inhaling a tiny, tiny bit of it, and so are your children. And actually, you can clean with a bit of bicarbonate of soda mixed with water. Some people use vinegar. I don't, because I don't like my house to smell like a chippy, but you can. Or you can just use water. You don't want the antibacterial wipes and sprays. You know, a kitchen is not a laboratory or an operating theatre. It shouldn't be sterile. And your kid's immune system needs those natural bacteria as a training ground. So clean, but don't make it too clean. And there are safe herbal alternatives to every kind of cleaning product there is. And open the windows. That's the other thing. If we go upstairs to the bathroom and open the bathroom cabinets, there's deodorant, there's perfume, there's aftershave, there's moisturiser, there's shampoo, there's conditioners, all sorts of stuff. Again, you can get completely safe herbal alternatives. But be careful. Don't believe all the advertising, because even if you go to a health food shop, which is much safer than going to a chemist or a supermarket, it may say, blah, 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 with lavender, with lavender. Doesn't mean that's the only ingredient. Read the ingredients carefully. And if it's got the Soil Association's certification, it really is safe. If it's got the COSMOS certification, it's certainly safe. That's an international body that includes the Soil Association as a member that certifies that cosmetic products, so-called personal care products, which I started calling personal scare products, because the petrochemical ones really scare me. Those are safe, right? And also you can check out the health and beauty pages of the Soil Association's website. Anything listed there is safe, because the skin is the largest organ of the body and it is a completely absorptive surface. You shouldn't put anything on your skin that you wouldn't put in your mouth. So moisturiser, you can use shea butter, you can use coconut oil, you can use these really safe natural herbal products. But if you wouldn't eat it, don't rub it in, because you're going to take it in. If you want to smell lovely, you can use essential oils, lavender, geranium, ylang ylang, jasmine. There's all sorts of wonderful smells. Lemongrass, rosemary. A patient said to me a few years ago, yeah, but they only last a couple of hours. That's right, because they're completely natural. So our biochemistry speaks to their biochemistry and our body knows how to break them down. So you can either put them on every couple of hours, or you can just wash once or twice a day and stop with the deodorant and the perfume altogether. Most perfumes have a long list of toxic ingredients like benzene, which is linked with leukemia. And the average bottle of perfume also has 14 unlisted ingredients, because if it constitutes less than 1%, there's no legal requirement to declare it. Now, the law around organic food is reasonably strict. But personal care products, it's not strict at all. You can label it organic when it's got only 1% organic ingredients. That's why I'm giving you these tips for how to check that such personal care products are really organic. So check out your bathroom cabinets when you get home. Let's go into the bedroom. What are you sleeping on? What is your mattress made of? Because most commercially produced mattresses are made of all sorts of synthetic chemicals, which we absorb through our skin at night, and we also inhale all night, especially if we've got the window shut. Now, don't panic, because a year or two after purchase, that outgassing process will be complete and the mattress will become pretty safe. But if you're buying a new mattress, please, please, please buy an organic one, especially for your kids, but also for yourself. People vary hugely in terms of how sensitive they are to this. I had one patient who got desperately ill with a new mattress. And for a month, she'd been saying to her partner, God, it smells dreadful. He couldn't smell anything. because his detox capacities of his liver were genetically just much better than hers. So his body was breaking these chemicals down as fast as he was absorbing them. He couldn't even smell them. She wasn't breaking them down. And within a month, she had kidney failure. Okay, I got her better, and it actually was remarkably simple. It was detox and nutrition. But these genetic differences are highly significant now. They had no significance for our health before the Industrial Revolution, because we didn't really have anything to detox except our own hormones and the occasional stinging nettle sting. Okay, so our bodies evolve very, very slowly, but the environment to which we were originally adapted has evolved much, much faster. And our bodies can't keep pace with it. That's why we need to do all these annoying things like buying organic and filtering our water and checking our kitchen and bathroom cupboards just to stay healthy. If you get moths in your clothes, don't put mothballs in there. They're made of paradichlorobenzene, that purple stuff, and it's the insecticide that I found most commonly in blood samples and fat samples taken from very sick people. Do you know what? Lavender oil kills moths. They don't want you to know this because there's no profit in lavender oil. It can't be patented because it's a naturally occurring substance, okay? So the forces of capitalism out there want you to buy the synthetic stuff, but we need to subvert them by sticking to the natural stuff. Our green fibres down in Totnes do a moth spray that's a combination of lavender oil and neem oil, N-E-E-M, from the neem tree, which they've been using in India for loads of medical purposes for about 5,000 years. The neem doesn't smell very nice, but the moths think so too. The lavender oil masks it, and it does smell nice, and, you know, the moths don't like lavender either. So there's natural alternatives. Now, one of the chemicals that's in your synthetic mattress and in your synthetic sofas and carpets and cushions and curtains are flame retardants. Flame retardants, which are polybrominated biphenyls. You hear the word bromine in there. It's a toxic halogen, just like the chlorine and increasingly the fluoride that are in your tap water. And those three chemicals all push iodine out of your body, damaging the thyroid gland. Low thyroid is incredibly common these days, both diagnosed and not diagnosed. The breast needs iodine. In women with breast cancer, I always found iodine vanishingly low. And people living on a traditional Japanese diet in Japan virtually never get breast cancer because they eat seaweed all the time. So eat your sushi, ideally homemade. Okay, so all these things can be a bit overwhelming, can't they? But if you buy naturally produced furniture, soft furnishings made from wool, cotton, hemp, linen, what I find fascinating is that those substances are naturally flame resistant. They are naturally, well, if you think about it, if you're a sheep, you want your covering, your wool, to be naturally flame resistant. If you're a plant like cotton or hemp or flax, which is what linen comes from, all these things, it's enough to make an atheist believe in God. It really is. All these naturally occurring things are herbal remedies for us, and they are naturally flame resistant. But if your soft furnishings are made of, you know, polyester and viscose and nylon, all these synthetics, which are essentially plastic, they're petrochemicals, they're very, very flammable. So by law, they have to be impregnated with another toxin, a polybrominated biphenyl or a polybrominated diether, to stop them catching fire. But those substances are toxic to you, to your child, when they're bouncing on the sofa. So get natural furniture or get it secondhand. All right. Yeah, so you can replace all those toxic things in your home with safe, natural versions. And the details of how to do that are in my book. And is anybody feeling a little bit overwhelmed? Yeah, I do apologise. What I suggest is that if you want to make some changes to make yourself and your family safer in a polluted world, as well as campaigning for change on a more global level. And by the way, all the campaign groups fighting this are listed in my book, you know, from Pesticide Action Network to all the charities making organic food available to the poorest people in our society, to a wonderful group called Mums for Lungs. There's loads of groups campaigning against this pollution. But if you want to make yourself safer, don't try and make all the changes at once, because then you will find it overwhelming. Just change one thing each week or one thing each month. You know, and if you can't buy everything organic, go on the website of Pesticide Action Network and they'll tell you the Dirty Dozen, right, that which means the fruit and vegetables which are most heavily sprayed if they're not organic. And they'll also tell you the Fun 15 or the 15 that you have to worry about least. So you can make all these changes gradually. But yeah, these are the reasons that so many of us, or these are some of the reasons that so many of us are getting so sick. Not necessary, not natural, within our power to change if we empower ourselves with the information. Now, my husband's here. His uncle Brian, who is 89, read the book and he said, Jenny, fascinating stuff, but I don't understand why I'm still alive. Okay, so I'm here to tell you that we're all still alive because our bodies are very resilient and we can cope with an awful lot of this poison, but everyone has their limit. So what we do in ecological medicine is we try to reduce the total load. We try to get rid of as many toxins as we can with methods like saunas, organic vegetable juicing, colonic hydrotherapy, Epsom salts baths, sprouting your own seedlings on your window ledge, using vitamin C in a very structured way to remove the heavy metals. And there are also specific nutritional supplements that get rid of specific toxins. So for every heavy metal and most other toxins, there are particular nutrients that help. Plastic is the one where we're stuck, but everything else we can detox. What we need to do with plastic is absolutely stop buying it. And there are lots of tips in chapter 3 of my book of how you can go through everything in your home that's plastic and replace it with something that isn't, something that's wooden or cotton or metal or whatever. And the producers have just had a big conference in Vienna where they completely fudged the issue and they whittled on about recycling and reusing and banning single use, which of course are very good, but it's tinkering around the edges. The only thing to do about plastic is to stop producing it. The producers will not stop producing it, and it's the oil producing companies who sabotage the efforts to reduce production because plastic is one of their most profitable products. If we stop buying plastic, they will stop producing it. This is about consumer power, right? Yes, they're very powerful and very rich, but only because we keep buying the junk food and the junk plastic and the crap they're making. So we vote with our wallets, we will change things. I'm going to take some questions now. Is there a roving mic? Yes, thank you. Oh, just one thing I forgot to say while the mic's going round. I've been talking about physical health, but mental health is involved with this as well. Because, of course, the huge rise in mental health issues, especially among our young people, is partly to do trauma and psychosocial factors and social media and the economic prospects they're facing, the ecological prospects they're facing, all those factors. But there is also a biochemical factor, which is that all the pesticides and the other substances I've been talking about, all the petrochemicals, are lipophilic. That means they're fat soluble. They dissolve in fat. You can't pee them out. So they're stored in the fattiest organ of the body, which is the brain. Right, and that is having a damaging effect on our mental health as well. Just putting that in there. Okay, there's a question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask in relation to water, what are you saying about filtering tap water? Mm-hmm. But is natural mineral water any better?
Well, natural mineral water is better if it's bottled in glass. But if it's bottled in plastic, you're doing yourself no good and you're doing the planet no good. And there's very few brands of mineral water that are bottled in glass. Highland Spring do some. But what I would say is get a water filter. It's cheaper in the long run than buying bottled water. And get a glass bottle. Carry it around with you in a padded container. There are increasingly refill stations, although not as many as there are here in most places. But carry your own filtered tap water around with you and use bottled water as an emergency. It's very hard to buy it in glass when you're out and about.
Thanks so much, Dr. Jenny. Just a question really in relation beyond petrochemicals. What would you say about those of us who are perhaps worried about phone mast radiation, Wi-Fi, individual phone use, that
absolutely
kind of thing?
Could you stand up? Because I can hear the question, but I can't see the questioner.
Over here.
Oh, you're over there. Hi. Thank you. Yes. Well, I didn't want to freak everybody out too much. So it is in the book. It absolutely is in chapter 6. And chapter 5 is about nuclear power, just to complete the kind of, you know, parade of terror. So I have only been talking about chemical pollution, but you're absolutely right. Electromagnetic pollution is a huge concern, because the form of electromagnetic radiation that's coming out of your mobile phone, the mobile phone masts, did you notice them springing up during lockdown like mushrooms after rain, and with about as much consultation, and your Wi-Fi router and your Bluetooth thingy and the ridiculous watches that tell you how far you've walked? And all of that is giving out radiation, which is completely inimical to our bodies, because the body is an electrical organ as much as a chemical one. And yes, unfortunately, researching this, I discovered thousands and thousands of papers published in proper, pucker, peer-reviewed medical journals linking the huge rise in brain tumours to the use of the mobile phone, especially in the young men who hold it touching their head, and the super high-powered businessmen who are using the phone all day. And in 1979, Chapel Allerton Hospital in Leeds, I was doing a neurology rotation as a medical student, and there was a chap on the ward with a brain tumour. And this was so rare that the consultant summoned all the other medical students from all over Leeds, even if they weren't doing neurology, whatever they were doing, come and see this patient. The poor chap had about 50 of us around his bed. And the consultant said to us, take note, he was terribly excited. The CT scan had just been invented. He was saying, look, see, he can't move his arm because that's where the tumour is. He said, take note, this is so rare, you will never see it again in your medical careers. That was 1979. I wish to God he was right. I have known many, many people with brain tumours. The link with, not with mobile phone usage, with incorrect mobile phone usage, right? So we don't have to abandon the technology. We have to use it safely, at a distance, texting, on speakerphone, not touching your head. If you read the manufacturer's package inserts in the box that your mobile phone came in, they say so, because their insurers have told them they must say so to cover themselves. They say, hold it at least 2 centimetres away from your head. Don't hold it touching your ear. So thank you for the question. Yeah, it's the other end of the electromagnetic spectrum from nuclear radiation, X-rays and gamma rays, which haven't gone away. Just to say, nuclear power is not green, it is not safe, it is not renewable, and it's certainly bad for children. Back in the 70s and 80s, we all knew that there were clusters of leukemia around Sellafield. We know that it increased vastly after Chernobyl, as did thyroid cancer among children, previously unknown. Same with Fukushima. Nuclear power is as dangerous as ever, and it's not green. And I spoke to Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace and the Green Party about this in researching the nuclear power chapter of my book. And they all said, oh, yeah, we agree with you, we know. And I said, why aren't you shouting about it? And they said, Another question?
Oh, sorry. You were talking about how you should think about, would you eat the skincare you're putting on your skin, which is very eye-opening. How would you advise about sun cream? Because surely that's a preventative measure against cancer.
Well, that's a story we've been told, isn't it? We evolved running naked under the African sun. All of us come from Africa. Some of us have migrated a bit too far north for comfort and got a bit pale, so we have to be a bit careful. But the way I would be careful is by gradual exposure, right? If you're going somewhere hot out in the sun and you're exposing a part of your body other than your forearms and your face and hands, which have had a British winter and haven't seen the sun, do it gradually, right? 10 minutes the first day, 20 minutes the second day, 30 minutes the third day. When you want to cover up with thin white cotton clothing. Because the vast majority of sunscreens are full of the most hideous list of chemicals. Read it and see. There are 3 safe ones at least. One's called Sweet Bee, one's called Badger. I can't remember the third. I've done an Instagram post about sunscreen quite a few times, and it's in in the book as well. There are a few safe sunscreens, but on the whole, the thing is to be sensible, graduate your exposure and cover up. And more dermatologists are coming to the view that actually it's the sunscreens causing the increase in skin cancer, not the sun. I'm sorry to be controversial, but it's genetic. I can't help it. I always have been.
Hi, I'm a student midwife going into my third year now, and my job is to empower and inform women. So what you said about the cascade of intervention in medicine.
Yes, I got the term from obstetrics.
Yes, and it's a terrifying thing. And I don't really have a very direct question about this, but how can I inform women about the medications that they take? Because more and more and more people are having more and more intervention, and this is not leading to better outcomes.
Yeah. So what you can do is read the pioneers of natural childbirth from the 1960s and 70s, like Janet Balaskas and Yehudi Gordon. You can study with the independent midwives who, although it's broken their heart, have defected from the NHS because they want to be able to give women empowering natural births. You can check out the Active Birth Centre, which is still going, was founded by Janet Balaskas. Yeah, you can find out how it's done. There's also an organisation called When Push Comes to Shove, which is, it's a good name, isn't it? And that's a mixture of midwives and doulas who are wanting to empower women to give birth, not necessarily naturally, but as they choose, with the pain relief if they choose and without if they choose. I mean, the caesarean rate is going up horrendously. And I know when I was doing obstetrics in 1980, we did a graph that actually correlated the caesarean rate with the consultants' golfing schedules. So that if you went in during the week and they wanted to nip off and play golf in the summer, you were going to have a caesarean. But if you went into labour on a Friday night, they were on shift all weekend. They couldn't get off anyway. They couldn't get away from the hospital. So you could labour naturally till Sunday. Read Wendy Savage as well. Read everything by a Savage Inquiry. Come and talk to me afterwards. There's loads of things you can read. But the intervention cascade is very interesting because what this lady is describing is how in childbirth, one intervention leads to another. So they give you a certain type of pain, say an epidural, so you can't feel to push. So then you have to have a Syntocin on drip, which gives very powerful contractions, or the other way around. Labour's not progressing. So instead of getting you up and walking around, they give you a Syntocin on drip. That causes severe pain. So you end up with the epidural, and then you end up with forceps or a caesarean. All of it's unnecessary. The newborn babies are being put on antibiotics just like that. It's all awful. But I think the larger point is, this is a feminist issue because obstetrics is the dark patriarchal heart of modern medicine. And I've been appalled to discover how little it's improved since the 70s and 80s. And this is a feminist issue. We have to keep fighting. But the intervention cascade in obstetrics and in medicine in general, I see people in their 70s and 80s who are on 9 or 10 different drugs, each to counteract the side effect of the one before. And you send them back to their GP for a review of the medication. And the GP says, we can take you off 6 or 7 of these. Well, hello, why did he leave me on those for 10 years unnecessarily? So that's the intervention cascade in medicine, but it's exactly the same in agriculture, right? So in agriculture, monocrop farming is the first artificial intervention. Then you need a pesticide. Then you need another pesticide. And then you deplete the soil. So you add synthetic fertilizers. So you deplete the soil further. And the reason that it's happening in both medicine and agriculture and that farmers and healthcare people need to talk to each other is because both are in the grip of the chemical industry and both are full of growing, aware minorities trying to get out from under the grip of the chemical and surgical industries and do things more in tune with nature. Work with nature, not against her. Thank you for the question. Come and talk to me afterwards.
Hi. I was just wanting to go back to the plastics in food. It's something that really annoys me. I've done my best to try and stop buying the obvious things like bottles and stuff. But even the best will in the world and using supermarkets, ethical, like Waitrose, Co-op, etc., there's still packaging in organic food.
There is.
In stuff. And it's so the problem is corporate. I've complained about packaging, but there's still always going to be packaging. Okay. So how do we stop
that? So there's two things to do about this. One is to get an organic veg box delivered. Companies like Riverford and many other smaller local ones will deliver all your veg and fruit and meat and cheese and eggs in paper bags. Right, in paper bags, right? There's absolutely no plastic packaging necessary. Furthermore, they can make little see-through bags that look like plastic but are made of sweet corn. They're made of maize starch and they have all the same properties. You know, they're useful, they're see-through, you can wrap your stub of cucumber in them. So yeah, the veg boxes, the organic veg boxes, do not have plastic. Secondly, here's a radical suggestion for anybody who wants a bit of fun. Let's go shopping at the supermarket, take everything home and unwrap it. And instead of throwing away all that plastic packaging and feeling a bit guilty and uncomfortable, keep it all in a pile, 50 or 500 of us. Let's take it all back to the supermarket the next day, dump it on the floor with a little note for the manager saying, oh, this is yours. Because if everyone did that, they would stop using it. You know, we used to buy rice and pasta and beans in big containers, and you bring your own paper bag or you bring your own cloth bag for shopping. And there's a description in chapter 3 of precisely how to do that. And some towns in Devon where they have done it completely. All the traders have got rid of the plastic. Paper bags made of cornstarch, and carrier bags made of natural fabric. So it is hard work, and it's a nuisance, I know, because we can't take anything off the peg. We have to invent it all ourselves. But there are plenty of precedents. There's a company called If You Care that makes paper bags again, and you can reuse and reuse and reuse them, and then you can recycle them. And if you're worried about the paper, you plant some trees.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I nearly fell over. What about the unalterable rubbish they're feeding us in ultra-processed food?
You have to see it as an addiction and you have to break the habit. I mean, they do make this food full of bad fats and sugar and salt to make and the texture to make them incredibly addictive. And you say what they're feeding us. It's what we're buying. Again, it's a question of empowerment. And I know it's hard. And I know it's terribly available, with organic fruit and veg is harder to get. But I think we just have to take control of our own lives in this respect and stop buying it. But I would take the addictive element seriously. Just like getting off sugar, getting off junk food, we need to treat it like breaking any other addiction. So if you're a sort of cold turkey person, you're an all or nothing person, then just go cold turkey and stop. But if you're someone who needs to do things more gradually, then change one meal each week to have absolutely nothing processed or artificial within it. It is perfectly possible to do it. I'm not saying it's easy, but you need the solidarity of other people around you trying to make the same shift.
Hello, thanks very much. Well, that, my question is following on from what the previous lady just asked about ultra-processed food. Mm-hmm. I'm the mum of a preschool child. I think there's probably lots of other parents here, and I think I've become a lot more aware of bad chemicals in toiletries and dishwasher tablets and food and ultra-processed food. And we're trying to make real changes at home, but we find when we go out into the big wide world, it's almost impossible to avoid. So yes, even in like my kids' holiday club, they're, you know, we've made a big list of things we don't want to have, processed meat or the rest of it, but they're still feeding them tip-tops of the treat with artificial sweeteners glycerol and goodness knows what else. Do you have any tips for how we can address the environment outside that we can't control when we've got children?
Yeah, I think, as I said, there's a charity called Mums for Lungs. I think we need to have one called Mums for Tums. It's a real problem. And all I can say is try and do what you can to read, study and raise the consciousness of the other parents in the groups and the clubs and the schools that your children go to, because you will be surprised how many mums and dads will say, you know, I was a bit uncomfortable about that, but I just didn't know what to do about it, and I didn't know what the alternatives were. It is a campaigning issue. And the other thing is to have only the good stuff at home And to tell your kids that the junk food companies are after their money and are after ripping them off and don't care about their health. So at least if they have the right stuff at home, they will only be having the bad stuff elsewhere. And for a while, they'll be terribly excited about the bad stuff that they get at little Johnny's house. But, you know, when they're a bit older, their taste buds will kick in again and they will value the good stuff they were given at home. And finally, we have to not become fanatical or fundamentalist about this. If you're basically strong and healthy and you have 90% healthy food, the 10% junk food that you can't avoid is not going to kill you.
Hi, can I just raise 2 points? Just one is, what do we do with all our household stuff that we want to get rid of that's toxic, furniture, bedding, things like that? Well, what do we do? It all goes to landfill. So and plastics, is it better to hang on to it? And the other thing is, I understand that there's a movement to build into manufacturing how to dispose of. So if a manufacturer is making something, they also have to think about how that good is going to be disposed of and broken down, and otherwise it's not legally allowed.
Well, that would be lovely. I hope they do that, but I'm not holding my breath. Your first question, it's a very real dilemma, especially with synthetic soft furnishings and synthetic clothing. Because, if you suddenly go all organic and chuck it all into landfill, can you still hear me? Yeah. You're just putting that stuff into landfill. So I think the answer is that those kinds of changes... Can you hear me now? No, I think the mic's gone off. No? Oh, all right. It is a real dilemma. So what I would say with the clothing and, you know, the synthetic sofas and carpets and so on is you can only make those changes slowly. What you can do is open the windows. Keep the windows open all the time, all year round. And so any chemicals that are still coming off that will go out. And when it's time to replace, only then, replace with natural organic fibres rather than synthetic ones. And with the clothing, there is an organisation called Sustainable Fashion Week. And it's really, really growing. I spoke there in 2022. Look up Sustainable Fashion Week, because they're aware of the toxicity of synthetic clothing. But what they do is reuse, repurpose, swap, sell, buy, and they keep it going as long as possible because they're trying to keep it out of landfill. And there are people now making clothes with natural materials like organic cotton and hemp, and so you could even make clothing out of stinging nettles. And they're using natural dyes from plants. And so when that clothing is finished, it can simply be composted because it was made all from plants in the first place. So this is a changeover that has to be gradual. There's no way around that. Okay, I think we're probably out of time now. So thank you for your kind attention. And I'm signing copies of my second book, which is called Getting Healthy in Toxic Times, An Ecological Doctor's Prescription for Healing Your Body and the Planet. Yeah. Well, the reason I'm stumbling over it is because the whole thing was chosen by the publisher. I wanted to call that book, the title of this talk, What's Got Into You? How Pollution is Damaging Our Health and What We Can Do About It. But they wanted the title to be terribly similar to the title of my first book, Staying Alive in Toxic Times, which is about seasonality and the evolutionary perspective on nutrition. So yeah, I will be signing copies of the new book, new-ish, over there in G Books at 5 o'clock, which is in half an hour's time. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.